Truthspresso, episode 19.
Face it, we all would rather sleep in this morning. That's why God gave us espresso, to kickstart our zombified corpses into hyperdrive. And now, giving your mind and soul the morning shot of truth it craves. This is Truthspresso with Daniel Minnick.
Well, hello, this is Daniel Minnick on the Truthspresso podcast, your host as always. And on this episode, I have a very special guest, the second guest ever for Truthspresso. And we have an interesting topic on this episode. For the first time on Truthspresso, we're actually going to talk about the existence of God. We're going to address arguments against atheism and really how should we as Christians live out our faith and really demonstrate to those who would question our faith that God exists, and what do we mean by God? Are we just talking about some man in the sky, some general theism, or a deistic God? But for this episode, our special guest is Tyler Vela. Tyler is a philosophy and English graduate from Sonoma State University. He holds a BA in Biblical and Theological Studies from Moody Bible Institute, a master's of biblical studies at Reformed Theological Seminary. He is also the author of the book Measuring McAfee: Why One Atheist's Attempt to Disprove Christianity Misses the Mark. And he runs a podcast called the Freed Thinker Podcast. So, Tyler, thank you for joining us on Truthspresso.
Thank you so much for having me. And just for one point of clarification, I'm working on my master's. I don't have it yet. I wish you could just grant it to me like that, though. That'd be great.
Yeah, like your university, not professor, but yeah, as if I were the president of the university. But yeah, that would be cool if I can grant the honorary doctorate or master's and so on like that. But
or just wave the wand and, you know, push my learning through time or something. Let me finish all the coursework. That'd be great.
So Tyler, you, I was looking at your bio online and I saw that you said that you were raised an atheist and converted in college. So could you just give me a little bit about yourself? Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became to be a Christian and get into apologetics.
Yeah. So I was raised in Northern California. A deep, deep, deep blue part of an already blue state. And I was raised completely non-religious. My mom is love her to death, but kind of a new agey ex-hippie and very, very happy about it, but very, you know, very loving. She wasn't like, you know, not like unsupportive of my Christian walk. And my stepdad is a lapsed Catholic. We never went to church, never talked about it. I was so ignorant of religion, and so like a lot of times atheists would be like, oh, but you were raised in the cultural milieu of Christianity. Not in the deep, deep blue that I was at. I actually remember after becoming a Christian, and hearing the Christmas carols for the first time and thinking, oh, that's what those are about. I really had no real idea of a lot of the Christian story growing up. So I about high school age became a pretty I would say an atheist, naturalist. I wasn't an anti-religious person. I wasn't one of these people, you know, after the rise of the new atheism, where I'm running around telling people they're stupid and anti-science and all that kind of stuff. But I thought religious people were, you know, that's quaint, but old and not really, you know, relevant anymore. And by the time I hit college, that had pretty well set in. And it was actually, kind of ironically enough, I took a, I was a philosophy major and I was taking a class in metaphysics, and section one of metaphysics was arguments for the existence of God. And I thought, well, that's interesting. My professor was an atheist, Dr. Botterell, very good professor actually. And I remember we were going through the arguments of the existence of God. We hit the moral argument. And that pretty much sealed it for me. He did a good job presenting it, balanced. He readily admitted that this was one of the stronger arguments and a hard one to overcome. And I quickly started to realize that the moral argument, for those who don't know it, is that if God didn't exist, objective moral values and duties wouldn't exist. Objective moral values and duties do exist, therefore God exists. It's a classic Modus Tollens argument. Well, I started quickly realizing that I believed the second premise, that objective moral values and duties existed, far more than I denied the first one, which is that if God did not exist, those wouldn't exist. And so that was very challenging for me. It was more obvious to me that something like raping or molesting or murdering a small child for fun and profit is actually evil and wrong. That was patently obvious to me. Whereas my denial of God was not so obvious. I had to get there through a bunch of other secondary arguments from premises that were far less convincing to me. So that really started a journey for me. I started looking into different areas. I started looking into my worldview at the time was naturalism. I started looking into naturalism and its ability to ground some of the fundamental features of reality, like the objective morality, like something from nothing, the philosophical distinction of the one and the many. And so over time, that's something that God used to pull me away from atheism slowly into agnosticism and then kind of a general theism. And I thought it would stop at that point. But then as every story goes, there was a girl, she invited me to church. I hated every second of it. To be honest, the first time did not take, I did not like church. I am still very much an outsider on kind of the subculture of Christendom in America. I still feel very weird inside of overly evangelical churches. So there's still some of that hangover. Cause I just wasn't raised with, didn't you learn this song in Christian camp? No, I didn't. But after time, after going to a church for a couple of different times, I tried a different, they had like a college age service, that was not so waspy, I suppose. And heard the gospel message there, and God used that to call me home. And so that is really when I became a Christian, which is when God effectually called me by the gospel.
So that's a very interesting and rather cool autobiography there, Tyler. So it's interesting that you were in college and you had an atheist professor having you study philosophical arguments, and basically it wasn't his idea to convert you, but because it's interesting, there's some people who would consider themselves Christians, and sometimes when they first take a philosophy or science class in college, and then they find the arguments there that are convincing somehow, and they somehow become atheists. So it's interesting that under an atheist professor, you as a naturalistic atheist, somehow becoming a Christian by looking really at arguments for atheism. So it's pretty interesting how God works in that regard.
Yeah, he was a great, fantastic professor. He was there to just challenge you to know why you believe, to think about things, to examine things. He wasn't antagonistic. I mean, he was very Canadian, so he was also very, very polite about everything. But he, I mean, it, so far as, I mean, he wrote one of my recommendation letters for me to get into Moody Bible Institute. So, I mean, I had an atheist professor writing me an academic reference to go to a conservative evangelical Bible college. So, I mean, he's a very, very, very good professor, but very challenging. I would watch him challenge, the Christians in the group just as much as he would challenge the atheists in the group. He was a very good, very good philosophy professor in that regard, very Socratic.
So he definitely wasn't your Richard Dawkins type atheist then.
No, definitely not. And to be honest, in my experience, most atheistic philosophy professors aren't. I mean, I've met a lot of atheistic philosophy professors, and they tend to be far more nuanced and well balanced and consistent than what you get from the new atheists and the online infidels and so forth, which is always funny. I actually got into a big I don't want to say fight. That's not the right word. Tiff. I don't know. Disagreement with a bunch of atheists in a group where I was trying to help them understand a far more robust version of atheism and saying, look, like this is standard fare for atheism among atheistic philosophers. I'm actually trying to help you guys here. And they were just like, well, you don't get to define things for me. And I'm like, I mean, okay. If you want to keep playing with mud pies in the slums, as Lewis would say, then go nuts. But I'm actually trying to steel man your position, and make it stronger for you. But they really didn't like that I was a Christian doing that.
So Tyler, before you became convinced of that in the existence of God, if you don't mind me asking, while you were an atheistic naturalist, what were some of the arguments that you held to that really convinced you that God did not exist?
It's an interesting question. I can take it two different ways. The first one is what my actual motivations were just sinful autonomy and a desire to self-govern my own life. That really is at the core of why I was an unbeliever. As far as the arguments why I would justify it to myself and to others, I thought the problem of evil and suffering was very strong. If there is an all-loving God, all-powerful God, how in the world can there, why is there this much evil and suffering? Specifically what appears to be, or what appeared to me at the time to be a gratuitous suffering, and evil. Mm-hmm. That was a big one. But really I point this out to atheists. And again, I try to tell them, like, I don't particularly like that I'm making your position stronger, but actually I think one of the strongest arguments for atheism is just kind of a banal, just unconvincedness, it's something kind of like what we get from the new atheist, but far more mundane, I should say. We don't believe in a bunch of other mythical things. Not to say that therefore theism is false, but just to say, until you convince me, I just don't have a lot of plausible reason to think that that's the case. That type of kind of banal skepticism, I think was probably one of my bigger reasons for being an atheist in kind of the justification sense.
Okay. So it's interesting to me that you said that one of the things that you used to justify atheism when you were a naturalistic atheist was evil and suffering in the world. So basically it had to do with morality. And then you said that in your philosophy class, you were studying basically the moral argument. So really the question of atheism, it seems like in the majority of the debate, it has to do with the moral argument. And, do you have an idea of why you think that is?
I don't know if that's the case for everybody, although I think it probably is the case in most instances. It definitely was for me. I think that because we are such ethical beings. And I don't mean that in that we always act ethically, but we are, yes, we are driven by ethical and normative values. I mean, we do it at every point in our life, and we do it constantly. It's just an unescapable reality of life. And it's very clear, throughout the scriptures that we want to be, that part of our sinful autonomy is that we want to be the rule unto ourselves. We want to be our own autonomous, we want to be our own autonomous king. We want to be our own ruler. We don't want anyone else to judge us. We want to be able to judge ourselves. We want to be able to judge others till the cows come home, but we don't want others to judge us. That overwhelming aspect, I think, of the human experience, is just going to make it a focal point for how we relate and understand God, whether that's in a loving sense or in a you know, an atheistic sense, where we attempt to flee and reject the existence of God.
So would you understand, like, most atheists, you know, if the idea of the appeal of rejecting the existence of God really is that kind of autonomy and trying to find one's own purpose in life, be the kind of the ruler of your own life, like you set the rules for yourself and so on. Like, would you understand that, you know, really the atheistic worldview is kind of like self-contradictory, in that one is trying to find so much meaning and purpose when the worldview of the atheist really is that there is no intrinsic meaning or purpose to existence?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the big problems that a lot of apologists point out, or try to point out to atheism, which is that existence, our human existence, our kind of existential experience of the world around us is largely unintelligible on naturalism. It's bizarre to say that there's no objective meaning and purpose in the world, but that we can invent our own meaning and purpose, and somehow that becomes an objective meaning and purpose. I mean, at the end of the day, that's just a legal fiction. That's just, the ironic thing, I don't know if you've ever heard this, but I said it as an atheist, and I heard it a lot growing up, which is that, you know, religion is wish fulfillment. You want there to be an afterlife. You don't want this life to be all there is. You want there to be meaning and purpose. And so, you invent a sky daddy in an afterlife, and it's mm-hmm. just wish fulfillment. But ironic. So we deny that it's wish fulfillment. We genuinely believe that there's an afterlife, right? So mm-hmm. if it's wish fulfillment, at least it's unconscious. For the atheist, they admit that it's wish fulfillment. They know that there's no meaning and purpose, but they want there to be. And so they're going to wave their magic wand and say, well, alakazam, therefore I have meaning and purpose. I know that it's not a real meaning and purpose, but I want there to be. And so therefore it's going to be like that. Like, I don't know what's worse, like an unintentional wish fulfillment, or just you're just intentional embracing wish fulfillment. So I don't know why that would be better.
So basically, it's like with the atheist worldview, like really everything is kind of an illusion, because it's like if you're trying to find meaning and purpose, yet, you know, you admit your mind is not, you know, infinite and perfect. It could be flawed. And how can you really trust that your mind is functioning properly? And yet you're trying to use this accident of, random chance against what amounts to be stardust, and mm-hmm. and you're trying to insist that, you know, you can actually figure out truth, and really you're trying to have meaning and purpose. Say like an atheist gets involved in some kind of crusade or some kind of march for something, some kind of political endeavor to save the whales or save the planet and so on, but you think about like the size of the universe and, you know, how tiny the earth is and how all of this, you know, reality is really just nothing but atoms banging around, like, mm-hmm. and, you know, and it's like, as a Christian, I just really have to ask the atheist, what really is the point of that? Why do you want to do anything like that? And especially for an atheist, it seemed like a waste of time, a waste of their precious life, trying to debate Christians as to why there is no God. Like, what's the whole purpose of really being an active atheist?
Right. Yeah. I mean, and there's, you know, there's another irony there that, you know, they always try to mock the middle. They don't understand medieval theology and cosmology. And so they, you know, they believe the revisionist history that everyone thought we lived in a flat earth and that the earth was the center of the universe and all that kind of, which is just garbage. It's just historical mm-hmm. nonsense. No one believed that. But you know, they'll do that and they'll say, oh, well, you know, you religious people until science came along, you guys thought you were the center of the universe. And then, but then their worldview is I'm the center of the universe. I'm the one that decides and makes the purpose. And I mean, it's, you have all these, you have kind of all these ironies that come about, in the atheistic worldview. I mean, which shouldn't be surprising. I mean, we know from the Bible, from Revelation, that idolatry always parrots the truth. We know that they're going to attempt to make themselves into something that is close but distorted enough to be false. I mean that they're while denying, you know, moral objectivity because they want to deny God. I mean, often, you know, the atheists will be some of the most moralistic, and I don't mean that they're the most moral people. They are the most ardently legalistic and moralistic people to ever haunt the planet. They are sometimes the most egregious over different what they perceive as outrages in society and things like that. I mean, they have some of the strongest sense of well, that's not fair, that's not just, that you can imagine. Well, I mean, if their worldview is correct, well, that's just not the case. I mean, we're just molecules crashing into each other, and you have a certain set of molecules, then you shake up and there's a chemical reaction that gives your response to something, and I have a different set of atoms, and you shake me up, and we're just bags of not so good looking, you know, water. Why should we think that one of us killing another one is bad, but one of us, you know, helping one of us, you know, across the street is good? They're just arbitrary. We just prefer what we just like one more than the other. Some of us do, but some of us don't. I mean, there's no reason except for kind of a majority rules imperialism mm-hmm. to say that one is better than another. It really is just kind of a nihilistic, you know, will to power where, it, you know, thankfully the majority in our case right now tends to be benevolent. But if that weren't the case, you know, there's no reason why, you know, if the majority was malevolent, why that would be any worse, morally speaking, than if the majority was benevolent. There's no transcendent standard that those are measured against.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know Tyler, have you ever like watched some of James White's debates? But one in particular, it was James White debated David Silverman.
I didn't see it, no.
Okay, so James White debated David Silverman on the topic of, is the New Testament evil? Now, of course, most atheists will like to go to the Old Testament to try to show how, you know, the God of the Bible is evil, and they'll say, yeah, the New Testament tries to clean him up. But David Silverman actually debated the topic, is the New Testament evil? And he was right. Trying to say that the New Testament makes God like really evil. And what's interesting, in his opening statement, he made the argument, because it, even like just the command to believe, and he was trying to say, like, you know, it's so evil, the idea that if you think something wrong, then you know, God will judge your thoughts, and that's so evil because how can you avoid thinking bad thoughts? And, you know, the whole thing about sending people to hell and how evil that is. But then later on in the cross-examination, James White was asking him, you know, presuppositional questions, and eventually it got down to, you know, questions about Adolf Hitler. And of course, with the kind of the moral relativism coming out, eventually the final question that James White asked David Silverman was about, like, is it really objectively wrong what Hitler did? And Silverman had to say, like, in my opinion, but it's only my opinion. And,
right.
You know, I'm like shocked by that. Like, he's trying to debate the topic, saying the New Testament is evil. And yet now when you come up with one of the most historical atrocities, he has to say, it's only my opinion that what Hitler did was evil. Like, how is he really presenting any kind of consistent argument? Because James White asked him, like, according to his worldview, how can he even call anything evil?
Right.
And it proved itself in the cross-examination.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It happens all the time, in these discussions. Constantly. I mean, you could come up with so many things. They'll protest to slavery in the Bible, but then they'll want to say that morality is an objective time, time after time or from culture to culture. And so it's like, okay, well then, you know, why do you get to evaluate a time in a culture, 3,000 years ago, in a completely ancient culture that's not yours? Why are you imperialistically imposing your, subjective morality upon that? It just becomes somewhat ironic and arbitrary when you start dealing with this level of kind of online infidel, meme-driven atheism.
Okay, so we just talked about, like, the moral argument for the existence of God and how naturalistic atheism can't account for moral objectives. So I'm going to go on to the topic of Scripture as the revelation of the God, the God who exists. And mm-hmm. I'd like to read Psalm 14, verse 1, and see if we can ask some relevant questions about it. So Psalm 14, verse 1, this is the psalmist King David writing. He says, "The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that doeth good." So mm-hmm. David said, the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. So when I was reading this verse recently, and I was thinking about some questions, like, if someone is an atheist, how does he address this verse? Because here is a declarative statement from David saying that the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. So the question is, was King David right or wrong in this statement? If King David was right, then atheism is wrong. If King David was wrong, then King David would be a fool, because, he would be a fool to say that the fool says there is no God if he was wrong about that and there is in fact no God. And Scripture would be wrong. But then, given if atheism were true, then how can we objectively define what a fool is?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're getting to the problem of an internal critique on their worldview, where in order for them to protest against Christianity, against the God of the Bible, against His Word, they need to be able to provide some type of rigorous standard and foundation for something like the laws of logic, which they simply don't have on their worldview. It's not possible. And there's actually some, again, I keep saying there's ironies when you go into their position. There's all kinds of ironies, especially when you're dealing with the online atheists, because the online atheists are going to say like, oh, well, you know, you shouldn't believe things unless there's objective, empirical evidence for it. And then you just go back and say, okay, well, you know, what's the objective empirical evidence for that statement? They don't have one. So, if you're dealing with someone like that, trying to get them to come up with some type of philosophical, transcendental foundation for something like the laws of logic on a naturalistic worldview, where they can only believe things that are objective and empirical. Sometimes I say the fool has said in their heart that the atheist has a good explanation. It's not gonna come about. They're not gonna be able to provide one.
Yeah, because it's interesting you just mentioned about like proving the existence of God with empirical evidence and so on. But then it's like that assumes that we have a rule for evidence, that we have standards by which we can evaluate evidence, and and that we have a functioning brain that can somehow actually sense truth and test truth, evaluate truth, that there is such a thing as a basis of truth to determine the truth of things, that evidence actually has meaning, that our brains can function. Like, really, how does the atheist know for certain that the human brain is capable of actually evaluating evidence, so to speak, and really determine whether God exists or not? Like, how do we know that, the naturalistic, evolution has really given us the tools to do that? Like, could our senses be playing tricks on us? Like, how do they know that?
Right. Yeah. I usually don't try to push, any worldview for certainty, but what you're hitting on is important, because when you're doing a critique of another worldview, you can do what's called an internal critique, which is that you assume that their position is true. Right, you're trying not to bring in any outside assumptions or any outside beliefs, and you try to use just the resources that are within their view. And if there's something within their view that creates a contradiction, then they have a defeater for their view from within it. It's a very strong way to oppose a view. So there's a Protestant philosopher named Alvin Plantinga.
Oh yes,
who came up with an argument that's the evolutionary argument against naturalism. Mm-hmm. And the argument's brilliant. it's basically that we have no reason to believe that evolution favors truth over falsity. There's zero reason to believe that. You might just assume it. You might think that it's true. We might think that truthhood has certain practical outworkings. But he points out that you might gain more evolutionary benefit from mild delusion than you do from accurate an accurate understanding of reality. And what's funny is, again, another irony, is that when you're talking to atheists and they're trying to make scientific cases for whatever their position is. And I'm rather agnostic when it comes to a lot of the scientific stuff. I don't get into really the science. I don't get into evolution debates or anything like that. I just it's not my field of interest or study. I just don't know enough, so I just stay out of it. Mm-hmm. But when they start getting into these types of conversations and they start, wanting to undermine miracles, and they want to start undermining, the historicity of the Bible, and they start going after, well, your memory is totally unreliable. And they start going, they start going after, well, you think that what you see with your eyes is what the actual world is, but your brain is actually interpreting a bunch of different information together, and it's stitching this thing together. That's kind of like a, it's like a patchwork artistic Picasso type of rendering of what the real world actually is. So you're actually, you know, being deceived in how you perceive the whole world. And the whole time they're going through these types of arguments to try to undermine the Christian claims, I'm just sitting there laughing. And I'm like, if that's true, and if you're an empiricist such that's all that you have as any type of possible justification for your worldview, you know, even if that is true, it doesn't necessarily undermine my view because there's a bunch of rejoiners for that. But if that's true, you just completely handed me all the reasons why empiricism fails as a means of justification. It's one of those things where it's basically, if your position is true, then I have every reason to believe that your position is false. It completely collapses in on itself because it's an incoherent system at its core. Its axioms fight with each other, such that it if it's true, it just has to be false. It cannot possibly be a true system.
Yeah, because it's interesting with the empiricism you mentioned there. Like, you know, I hear arguments from atheists, like, you know, mocking things in the Bible. You mentioned miracles, like mocking things like that. Like, you really believe that a snake talked, or Balaam's donkey, you really believe that a donkey talked? You know, how silly, that you believe this supernatural stuff and miracles, but then, you know, as a Christian, when we really think about what they're relying on as a naturalistic evolutionist and their idea of evolution, you know, it's like, I want to ask the question, like, well, according to your worldview, like, fish evolved into eventually humans and we talk, you know, like, what's the basis in your worldview for why we can talk and why it's so ridiculous to believe that some other creature like, you know, a donkey or a snake could ever talk? Like, why can we talk, and why is that so normal? And, you know, why don't we have other creatures that can talk? Like, why are humans so special, and why do we rely on something like that as empirical, testable truth as a naturalistic evolutionist? Like, why is that so bizarre for you to believe?
Right. Yeah, I mean, and they could have some responses to that, but ultimately, you know, you could even come down to the question of why do we even think that any of this speech is intelligible? Like, why? I mean, atoms don't have what's called aboutness. Atoms are entirely indifferent to other atoms, right? So why is it that the cluster of atoms that's in my brain can somehow convey meaning about this other cluster of atoms out here, right? There's all of these problems that have to do with aboutness or intentionality that come from it. But the other, you know, another problem with that type of, you know, objection to Balaam's donkey or what have you, is a lot of times they'll be like, oh, well, that's just silly. You know, scientifically, we know that can't happen. And I just want to say, well, you know, no, scientifically, the only thing we know is that under normative conditions by purely natural processes, that can't happen. But no, you know, nobody's claiming that. if someone was standing in front of you saying that a donkey was talking, you know, by purely normative and natural processes, then yeah, that person's probably a moron. But no one's claiming that. It's a miracle for a reason. That's because it's not following normative natural processes, and that's exactly why we know that it's a miracle. In fact, if we didn't have these natural, normative processes, we wouldn't be able to identify if anything was a miracle, because everything would be random and everything would be all over the place. Which, you know, would just be so strange. You would have to deny causation, which they do, which is also, again, ironic to avoid, you know, that God was the cause of the creation. They'll say, okay, well then, you know, it could happen without causation. Okay, great. If you've just denied the principle of sufficient reason, you've just denied a major axiom of what makes science intelligible. You can't have both. So, you know, it's just their position is so incoherent that it's kind of a cliche, but it reminds me of someone that's trying to, you know, constantly put down the bump in the rug, and they try to defend it over here, but it just pops up somewhere else, and they have to run over and try to push it down there, and it just pops up. Like, it's just any time they want to defend, you know, their position against our objections, or they want to try to object against Christianity, they do it in such a way that if their objection is true, it proves that their position is false. It happens constantly.
So Tyler, I want to get into another passage of scripture, which I'm sure you're familiar, and get your thoughts on it. Romans chapter 1.
Yep.
Yes. Verses 18. To verse 22, it says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath showed it unto them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead," or divinity, theototos, so that they are without excuse, "because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools." So this passage is pretty interesting. If this is the word of God, what does that say about about the atheists and their thinking? And if it's not the word of God, then this is ridiculous to say this, right?
Right. Yeah. And you know, this verse actually has a lot of, you know, has a lot of value for the Christian trying to engage with the unbeliever. You know, I point to this passage pretty often, because what will happen is that, you know, the unbeliever will say, "Oh, well, you know, I don't have enough evidence to believe it. You know, I'm just neutral." Right. They have this, the neutrality myth that, well, I'm just here as neutral ground, and you just, you know, I'm just a receptacle, and you just have to give me evidence for me to believe. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I just point out, well, you know, if my position is true, then you're not actually neutral. And you have ample evidence. God tells us that you have plenty of evidence, you know, from the very creation of the world, you have evidence of the existence of God, his divine nature, his eternal powers, invisible attributes, right? You actually have plenty of evidence to go on. When people start arguing, you know, the kind of the supposed problem of divine hiddenness, where, you know, if God exists, why is he hidden? I just come and say, well, I just disagree with the starting point. I don't think God is hidden. I think God is manifest to all. Now, does that mean that God, you know, all of the specific, you know, Christian theological information is present? No, but you know, you might not get, you know, the death, burial, and resurrection of God incarnate, you know, the second person of the Trinity, for our sin by looking at the stars. But there's enough there that everyone is without excuse for belief that God exists. And so we have ample evidence. I nuance what I say, when we say that we suppress the truth and unrighteousness. Mm-hmm. A lot of times this will come across as, oh, well, you know that God exists, you just don't want it to be true, and so therefore you suppress it. Like it's a conscious thing that they do. I don't think that is the case. I think that when it says they suppress the truth in unrighteousness, that it is actually our unrighteousness, our love of sin, our love for self, that suppresses the truth about God around us. Such that we might not even observe that it's there. It's actually our unrighteousness is taking control. So I'm careful to try to say that this, you know, these people, they're not being dishonest when they say they don't believe in God, or something like that, or they don't have evidence. But the truth has been suppressed. It's been the picture is you know, a force, something that's submerging something underwater. So it's no longer apparent or visible. Their unrighteousness is this weight that submerges it below their level of conscious awareness, I think. But it still doesn't mean that I need to accept their supposition that somehow God actually is hidden, or that there actually is no evidence that is present all around them. What we need to do is challenge their unrighteousness, not necessarily try to you know, tickle their intellect and work on their ground, you know, by affirming their presuppositions. We should not do that.
Yeah. So the passage does have like the presupposition that everyone knows, like it's manifest that God exists in some way, but you know, just as the Bible says, you know, having their conscience seared with a hot iron, you can be self-deceived, you know, like where there's such a strong, you know, position that God does not exist, that you can lead yourself to believe that in a certain sense, you know. So it's not like some, yeah, like as you said, they're not being like blatantly dishonest, but there is that manifestation, that awareness.
Yes.
So, okay. So yeah. I agree.
Yeah. 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 And I think that, you know, in everything we were talking about, we see these, the reason why I kept pointing out to all those ironic things, about their worldview is because, they continually show, that they are made in the image of God. And they continually show that they live in God's creation. It's unavoidable. There's a reason why, when you asked, you know, why is morality so central to these questions? Well, you know, because we're made in the image of God. We are moral agents that are meant to reflect his goodness and his righteousness. That is a fundamental aspect about ourselves. And when the atheist does that, obviously they do it in a broken way, and they do it in a way that doesn't give recognition to their creator. But when it says that which is known about God is evident within them, that's part of it. That imago Dei, that image of God, the you know, the ethical nature, the personal nature, the communal nature. I mean, all those facts, the ability to logic and reason, the ability to relate to creation. I mean, all these things, our ability to rule over creation. I mean, that was the original mandate. All of these things are what is known about God, and it's evident in ourselves. We should be able to, the first thing when we look at ourselves is we should be able to understand that we are made in the image of God. And so, and because God exists and because God is there. I wrote, you know, when I was at Moody Bible, my senior thesis was a directed study on, Van Til, the Reformed theologian and philosopher, and what's called the noetic effects of sin, right? Or the impacts of sin on the mind, and how we think. And I argued that what happened at the fall, and what sin does, it doesn't necessarily make us stupid, right? The fool isn't stupid, yes. Right? The fool can be a brilliant person. They're not a stupid person, but they're unwise, because they don't understand the most fundamental things about themselves and about reality, and so therefore they make poor decisions because they do things in unrighteousness. And so I argued that what sin actually did, what the fall actually did in our minds, was it broke what Buber called the I-thou distinction, right? Mm-hmm. I argue that before the fall, I think that we would have done everything with reference to our creator. We would have understood, you know, if I'm eating a sandwich, I understand that I exist as a creature in God's creation, and I'm thankful that he has provided this for me. I would have done that, you know, by nature. Whereas now we have to constantly remind ourselves to pray for our meals and hope that we remember to pray for our meals. Because that connection, the I-thou connection, the creator-creature connection, is what is broken. And so we now do things with reference to ourselves rather than with reference to God. And so that's what makes the fool, is that they are trying to live in God's creation as if it is not God's creation.
Hmm. Yes, definitely excellent points there, Tyler. And I remember a while ago, I mean, I haven't published it yet. I'm thinking of like recording at some point, but I was writing basically about the presuppositions of, you know, atheists and mm-hmm. and really the concept of like, where's the evidence? So I was like writing basically a narrative explanation for the evidence of creation, and like starting off with you know, us as humans and how we think and do things, and then going down to atoms, like starting off like shrinking down, looking at cells, the complexity of cells, and all the way down to atoms and subatomic particles, and then like, okay, now we got this perspective of how complex things are to ourselves, and then all right, now let's go back up to us as humans and start to zoom out larger and see how tiny we are on Earth, and how you know, how tiny the Earth is in the solar system. Basically zoom out and explain the size of the universe with the billions of galaxies with billions of stars. So basically this all-encompassing, just broad look at all the evidence and complexity of creation. And then, so then, you know, when an atheist asks, like, where's the evidence? So then, like, okay, so now do I need to go to the complexity of the eye, or now do I need to go to the motor of a cell? Like, what more evidence do we need? Like, if we talk about the universe in, you know, the size of the universe and subatomic particles, like, how am I going to convince an atheist that God exists if I just have to take another part of that universe and explain the mechanics of that? Like, how is that going to count for evidence to convince them? And it seems like there's more to being an atheist than just needing more evidence of something I forgot to mention and how it's composed to convince an atheist. Like, there's got to be something to, like, what is it that we need to do to convince an atheist that God exists after just showing really the entire makeup of the universe?
Right. Yeah. And this is where, you know, in the Reformed tradition and in what's called presuppositionalism is mm-hmm. we understand our job is not to convince them of that. Mm-hmm. you know, when we're doing apologetics, my goal is not that I'm so smart and I give such good arguments that I can convince them to believe in God, right? I mean, the Reformed apologetic is so different than what you get nowadays. You know, I have great respect for people like William Lane Craig, and you know, mm-hmm. don't get me wrong, I'm trying to knock them, yes. but our approach is so very different from theirs, because we don't think that we're on common ground with the unbeliever. We don't think that we share, you know, a neutrality with them, such that if we just provided them the right type of evidence, that they would believe. That's not our responsibility. Ventil, you know, used to talk about, it was a little extreme, but you know, he's talking about, you know, dropping a nuke on their house. The the purpose of it was just to destroy their worldview, to destroy their vain autonomy. The goal, you know, my professor, my Ventilian professor used to say, okay, well, that's a little violent, but the goal might be to, you know, to puncture a hole in their main line and you know, slowly flood out and deteriorate their house or something like that. I don't know if that's much better, but the, you know, the purpose of it is to destroy their attempts for vain autonomy, is to show that they are, whether they like it or not, you are a creature in God's good creation, and you are at enmity with Him. You are seeking to live an autonomous life apart from your Creator, and that is not going to end well for you. And you are, while you are thinking you are, you know, rational and reasonable, you are actually fleeing and running from the very foundation that is even possible for reason and rationality, let alone for morality, let alone for any meaning or value or purpose in this life, because you are running from the thing that grants meaning, from the thing that purposed you here. So there's a very different approach in a Reformed apologetic compared to, again, what you're going to get from kind of a classical or evidentialist.
Okay. Well, Tyler, those are excellent thoughts. And I know we can talk, you know, for hours about this stuff, but running out of time, I'd like to wrap some things up for this episode. So is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners with, or anything you'd like to plug before, when we wrap up?
You've already mentioned the podcast, which is where, you know, I have a lot of this information, and different episodes there, and, they can go there if they want to, and find that. My exhortation to anyone who's looking to, get into apologetics, is to not get into apologetics. and I don't mean that in a bad way. A lot of people think that getting into apologetics is I need to go and I need to read 1,000 books and I need to, you know, I need to be able to overcome all these objections and remember all these, you know, syllogisms and do all that kind of stuff. And if that, you know, if you can do that, you know, God bless you. But if, but don't think that that's your obligation. You know, you people hear passages like 1 Peter 3:14 and think that, well, you know, we're our obligation is to make a defense, and so therefore I have to do apologetics. Well, actually, that's a very evangelistic verse. The defense of that is for the hope that's in us. It's the defense of that is Jesus Christ and Him crucified. It's the gospel itself. If you're worried about being an apologist, then don't be an evangelist, because that's what we're actually biblically called to. We're believe it or not, we're not, you know, I'm going to make a lot of apologists angry. We're not actually biblically called to do apologetics. I think it's helpful. I think it's useful. Don't get me wrong. But our mandate as the church is the Great Commission. It is to preach Christ and Him crucified and to make disciples of all the nations. If you are feeling called to go and reach the lost, make sure that you are an evangelist first. You know, study the Bible, get some good commentary, study the scriptures. And then as you engage with unbelievers, don't be afraid to say, I don't know. You know, let me go think about that and get back to you. Or, you know, maybe an answer in the right direction is such and such. I think that might be, but I'm not quite married to it. Let me think about it. I haven't actually thought about that before. Don't be afraid to just humbly admit that you don't know, or you need to go research, and you'll get back to them on something. It's going to be far more effective and far more beneficial, and you're going to learn a lot more that way than trying to be a know-it-all and learn everything, you know, in one go. It's just not going to happen that way.
Amen, Tyler. So yes, and in 1 Peter 3:15, the word apologetic is right there. Trying to remember how it's conjugated, but yeah. So the verse there, 1 Peter 3:15, is an apologetics verse, but it's really about, as you said, evangelism and sharing your faith. And really the best apologetic is to demonstrate the truth of the gospel by sharing the gospel and letting the gospel shine in your hearts. As Jesus said, my mind went blank, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm talking about Jesus said that, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify the Father which is in heaven. So really the gospel itself is, you know, the greatest apologetic, because it carries all the meaning of the universe in it, and all the reason for creation and redemption itself. And so a lot of people have been converted from atheism to Christianity by the simple gospel without hearing, you know, the greatest evidence for the existence of God from some kind of scientific concept. But Tyler, I'd like to thank you for being a guest on Truth Espresso, and I will include links to your website, your podcast, in the show notes for this episode. So, Tyler, thank you for being on here, and God bless.
God bless you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for waking up with Truth Espresso. Good morning, and God bless your day.
Hey friends, Daniel Minnick here again. If you liked waking up to this episode of Truth Espresso, I would really appreciate it if you would rate it on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever application you use to listen to Truth Espresso.